when I can scream loud enough to hear Miss Cook if they want me to. We would, our hopes today is that in running through with as many of the legislators as is possible to get together, to go through where we are at this stage of the game in the foundation form of our education. And leaving it with that, Larry says he has on his bulletproof vest, and we'll start firing at him when ready. And when Larry, you of course start to hear presentation, you will let us know if you want questions as you go or when you finish. Without further ado, then I want to welcome those members of the committee, those legislators who are here. And Rick, let's start with you and just introduce yourselves around the table, and then we'll introduce you.
Rick Pettyjohn, representing South Anchorage in the State House.
And Ron Larson, if there's any members of the press here, I would like to know that I am representing the Matt Sue, not Palmer.
Must have had a person.
You can tell by the fire in his eyes. I'm Arlo Sturgeluki, and State Senator represent Midtown in South Anchorage. East Midtown.
Betty Perry Camp, and I represent Interior.
Edmund DeGree, Senator from the Dole District. Alice Hanley, Representative West Anchorage.
Sounds like I'm Representative Thompson from Kodiak representing the Bush.
With that, and I'd like to welcome the Commissioner of the Department of Education, those board members, and Commissioner Reynolds. It's all yours.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Members of the legislature, this is a very special opportunity for us to see you here before legislative sessions begin, because we'll have a chance, I think, in a very relaxed way to get into any of the kinds of problems or concerns that you see as you take a look at this product, which is nearing completion present time. Before I just say a couple more words about it and introduce Larry, I'd like to introduce two members of the State Board who are here at the moment. I'm sure you know them, but President Ernestine Griffin is in the second row right here, and Bill Eubank right here. I'm sorry, I didn't see Barney come in. He wasn't there when I looked around. Excuse me. Sorry, Barney.
That was perfect timing on this part, and we planned it well.
You did. You just one of those fellows that gets there just when the orchestra cranks up. The Formula Funding Advisory Committee was put together after the very considerable difficulties we had trying to prepare a proper piece of legislation for you last year. It began meeting regularly as soon as Larry Huxell came on board with the Department of Education in April and May, and it had been meeting regularly ever since. It is a wide-ranging committee in terms of background and experience, including legislators and legislative representatives, as well as people from the education community, and I mean from the superintendency, from school boards, from the state board from time to time, from the teachers' association, and from municipal organizations. It has tended to be one of these committees, unlike the one a year ago, which instead of getting poorer and poorer attendance as we went along, it has increasing attendance. You'd think we were running a floating crap game or something or other on the basis of the way people tend to come into this thing. And more are coming all the time. That analogy may not be badly drawn when we get down to the facts and figures later. The fact is, then, every meeting has required more chairs in the same hall, and the next meeting is scheduled in a larger hall. So there must be something going. It has been characterized by presentations from special interest groups in education, ranging from special education, gifted and talented, centralized correspondence. I'm sure you're all familiar with all of the special interest groups, maybe more than we are, vocational education. They've had opportunities to work in separate committees with Larry and then to come before the larger committee. The issues have been wide open. As you may learn, if you don't already know, Larry is an extremely good listener. He has extraordinary background in school finance, having developed a finance act for New Mexico, and having studied and taught school finance for years. One of the things that happens when he's in the chair is that when a question is brought up that has high technical kinds of background and need in the discussion, Larry has it. And that means that if somebody has a piece of the truth but not the whole truth, he's able to correct that because his experience is wide-ranging enough to set whatever the statements are quite straight. Now, the place we are today is about where the red line is on the graffiti that's been produced on either side here, the top red line. We have completed or come very close to completing the theoretical framework, as he will describe to you. We have not gotten to the figures yet, and there are no figures yet, although the great day for revelation is next Monday, when some of the first figures will start being produced. So we're still, as you can probably guess, in what would be called the era of good feeling. Everybody is agreed. The theoretical base is all right. But I notice when I get letters from various people, including Bob Green and others, they tend to say, to this point, we are in agreement. So that although we would like to get everybody to sign on to the theoretical basis for this, it seems to me that a number of people have reserved the option that when they see the figures, the theoretical thing may not seem quite so desirable. But at this point, we have solid theoretical support, and we presented that to the State Board of Education here in Anchorage last Tuesday. The State Board spent a couple of hours on one day and then another half an hour on the next day and voted to support, having questioned it, this theoretical framework. So that's where it stands. And it comes to you at that wonderful moment when we have talked about all the issues, we believe we found agreement, particularly within the context of Alaska and Alaska's financial needs for funding of schools. And it's at this point that it's appropriate, and that's why we welcome this opportunity, Senator Fahrenkamp, to be invited here to meet with you to present this. I think without any further comments about it, you ought to hear, see, review what is not a very long paper when you think about school finance with Larry, who has been the responsible person for bringing disparate viewpoints together and making some sense out of them so that we could proceed to write a school funding act that would make sense. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Commissioner. Any members of the first year have questions, please, before we get into our...
Madam Chairman, I may have one. Were there any guidelines set up to the commission as it does its work in relation to, and I'm going back to the earlier study that was done that came out with the cost of funding education, I think it was $700 and some million on that one page, where actually we put out 563. So were there any, say, top guidelines, say, you could come up with a formula that will adequately distribute X amount of dollars, or was it open-ended, just trying to find out what the cost of education is?
No guidelines along that that line that you're suggesting, but obviously, as you'll see as Larry goes on, we're working within the same numbers of dollars. But the theoretical framework is simply that, and given that number of dollars, this theoretical framework will work. So it was not an open-ended kind of situation. It was simply deal with these issues, develop the framework, and there's never been any suggestion in those meetings, and I've attended almost all of the last ones, about where we would go in terms of money, except that we were making the presumption that it would be within the framework of the available dollars this year.
Yes, I think so. I'm just concerned that whatever you get is flexible enough to be able to meet the dollars that are available.
We have offered, we've operated totally within the concept of trying to build the theoretical design separate and apart from the cost, where the cost becomes strictly legislatively determined, and the formula very simply shows where the dollars on a dollar per unit base would go based upon the ingredients of the formula, which we'll review, and we'll spend some time on the dollar aspects.
Yes. See, that is a point that does bother me some. Like last year, theoretically, the study we got said we needed 750 million. Practically, we only had 500. If the same thing comes out with this study, and I realize we haven't got the dollar figure put to it, but whatever it is, in order to make it work, it's going to have to fit somehow within the dollars available.
Absolutely. We've worked that way.
I think that's where we are, and right. One of the reasons it was time for us to get together. Mm-hmm. Because if this is the philosophy, we can agree on that, and if we feel that it is equitable, or that it is equitable. We're the point now, if I understand it correctly, and correct me if I'm wrong, Larry, that you can take the amount of dollars you have and know exactly where it goes all through the framework of the program.
And the
adjust the dollars, then just adjust
the way the budget document has been prepared to date would fund the foundation formula or the proposal within existing dollars, and the only increase that's been talked about at all within the confines of the budget document would be dependent upon the save harmless or hold harmless feature, which might be required in any phase-in of this formula, which, as I will get into, we're looking at both restricting increases as well as cushioning decreases. Each of you should have the orange packet. Within that, there are several pieces of information. On the left-hand side, you have the minutes of the last Funding Formula Advisory Committee meeting dated September 1920. I trust that each of you or your offices have received these over the course of about the last 4 months or so. We have tried to ensure that each legislator or legislative office received copies. On the right-hand side, you see some of the paperwork that's been prepared in the assistance of presenting the proposed formula. The one described the description of proposed school funding formula dated September 30. This goes through with a paragraph or two explanation of a number of the items that we'll be talking about this afternoon. The last two pages entitled the functional outline are the two that I will use as a guide. The other paragraphs generally are in support of that. There are other items within the minutes of September 1920 that also talk to some of the policy issues as we go through. The other backup data that you have is a sheet on special education program categories, which is dated today's date, October 3rd, and that there are some changes made since the last meeting of the Special Education Standards Group, so this is the most complete document at this point. There's a paper on the state training and experience ratio schedule, which is a major adjustment factor. And there's a table entitled Small School Weighted Students, and that's another major aspect of the proposal that as we get to this, we can spend time on it. And I'll try to pause throughout on different components so that we don't try to go through the whole thing and and then look at it. So I'd like us to be informal, and as questions come up, we'll try to handle them as we go on each of the components. In preface to actually getting into the outline, I would like to just make some remarks that have kind of guided the work of the Funding Formula Group since April when I became involved. And as each of you know, it was in the 1983 session, or the last school year, the 82-83 year, the last year under the old formula. And of course, there's been 3 years, or this is now year three, of what would be looked at as trying to put together an acceptable school funding proposal. And although it's easy to say we spent 3 years on this project, it's really just the last 5 months that we can really try to pull together some of the things that were done in the name of the resource cost model and the RCM. And what we have tried to do in the last 5 months of picking up pieces that we felt were supportable from the resource cost model process, utilizing those that we felt were applicable, which in all honesty were very few. The RCM model was a highly complex, data-hungry model that we frankly could not support. And each of you probably know very well a lot of the discussions and problems that you heard and went through. We started off in April by acknowledging that the RCM was too complex. We frankly could not support that type of a proposed model for school funding. And so our basis since April has been simplify. We must simplify. We've operated kind of in the mode of what's the maximum complexity with which we can have data that we have confidence in. And so the RCM was operating with 162 programs at the time, and we're operating in the same vein of program of less than 10. And as we go through those, we have to keep in mind that we are dealing with a simplified school funding model if we're looking at the RCM as a comparison. We know that the old formula was unsatisfactory based upon some reasons, probably different for any of us who might look at it. and it was unsatisfactory, or the evidence is that it's unsatisfactory and that it was put aside. So for 3 years, we've been operating on an interim base where there's a specified dollar per ADM for each student during the first quarter count. The proposed formula then that we are looking at, our guide words throughout the last 5 months, in which we've been dealing strictly on the theoretical design base. What components should be included? What programs should be included? How will they be included? What are the cost factors that are important in a school funding proposal? How can we put those together? Largely, we are at the end of that process, although there are still some hanging questions that we will be dealing with today. We've tried to build a rational base, and the three words that have kind of been the guiding lights is that the formula must be understandable, defensible, and ultimately passable. And so we've been dealing in the theoretical area, trying to put it together with those words being our guide. We know that the real test of any formula is in the practical application. We have purposefully stayed away from data application until this point in time. Our feeling is that we need to put together an understandable and defensible, rational basis so that when the data does come out, and we can look at the problems that will be there in the light of what that basis is. We know things will need to be handled. There will be adjustments that have to be made. No formula strictly based upon a theoretical background is going to come up with perfection. And even if it did, we must remember that we are comparing to a current base, which isn't perfection either. But the problem will be, as we all know, that whether the current base is perfect or not, if it yields a higher dollar per pupil amount than the new one, it's better, and if it yields lower, it's worse. And we all know that's the basic premise at the ultimate bottom line of school finance. So all the rest of the theory is all nice, and we will use it as best we can. But we know, beginning next week, it's a meeting scheduled Monday at 1:30 in the boardroom, in Juneau, where we have invited anyone that's interested to look at the first run of data. And the purpose of that is simply, as one more step in the developmental process, we have to look at some point, what is this doing? And there are several areas that we recognize that are likely adjustments that we have not included in the first run of data. And so we know adjustments will have to be made, and we'll talk about some of those as we go through. The real problem, I think, that always happens is that the first run of data will show some huge winners, some huge losers. The cover letter that will go out with that will likely begin with, "It's neither time to rejoice nor to panic." And hopefully that message will be carried. But that's what we'll try to stress, that the first numbers that come out are not the final draft. It's another step in the developmental phase. It's purpose, as I said before, let's see where the problems are. And with those problems, we will look at what has to be done, what needs to be done, what can be done, hopefully still staying in the understandable and defensible realm of looking at what happens. We know that our comparison base is the current dollars. Whether rational, irrational, understandable or not, the current basis of dollars is the comparison base, and everyone is going to look at, what am I getting right now? And today's losers, or those people who feel that they are losing under the current formula, may very well be those in a redistribution who would see that they are winners, and the obvious is obviously true. What we do know is going to happen is that there will be a redistribution of dollars. Now, what we are doing is taking 84-85 data, so all of the student data that's in the formula is fiscal 85 data. Obviously, it's the only data that we have right now. So fiscal 85 data is in the formula. We distributed approximately $490 million through the State Foundation, including the PL874, 80%. And we will take that same amount and redistribute it as if this formula were in place. And we also must keep in mind that that excludes city-borough contribution, which is highly unequal, and it also excludes the 20% of PL874, which is also unequal. And that raises the equity questions, which we will talk about when we get to that point. There will be a redistribution. Well, for example's sake, let's say there weren't. There was not a redistribution, and we simply were developing a formula which came out which said everything we're doing right now is right. We'd have just as many concerns because there are a lot of people feel what we're doing right now is wrong. And that's why there's been a 3-year effort to try to come up with an alternative. And so if we come up with the very same thing, we'd have problems. We will not come up with the very same thing, and we will also have problems. And so the major problem as I look at the next few months of putting together this plan in form to present to you in January is to look at the initial redistribution, which we'll see next week, compare it to current dollars, and then begin to look at rational reasons why there are differences and if there are some obvious areas that we are under or over adjusting, and then let's look at how we can make adjustments in order to best put together a formula that will meet as many needs as we can. But the redistribution will not be a surprise. We know that's going to happen. It raises the issues of hold harmless. It raises the issues of a phase-in. By those two terms, I'm really using hold harmless to mean there will be some need in this formula, basically any new formula, realizing that typically school finance reform demands a huge increase in state revenue sources. We're not faced with that luxury, and so it will be more difficult in the absence of new revenues to smooth over problems to look at phase-in or hold harmless provisions. Hold harmless would mean that we would cushion losses over a period of 2 or 3 years as a formula could be phased in. At the same time, the proposal from the funding formula group is to limit increases so that no district could get an increase greater than some specified amount, just as no district could suffer a loss in excess of some amount. The obvious thing that happens here is that whatever money is saved in year one by not funding full increases can also help cushion a loss in a hold harmless and restricts the amount of any new revenue that might be required just to fund a hold harmless provision. And so the phase-in would accomplish both ends of the spectrum. Depending on what the numbers are, we could be looking at 2, 3, maybe more years in order to phase in fully a new formula. Our task now is to present a rational formula that's acceptable, that looks like it should be phased in, and looks like it's a long-term solution. One of the most important points of this proposal, as I see it, is that it is capable of being altered and modified relatively easily as new data comes in. Our data is not perfect by any means. We have made, I think, great efforts this year to get consistent data in a timely manner for fiscal year 85. It's an initial effort at getting year-end revenue and expenditure data. It's not perfect. It's probably the best there's ever been. It will get better. And as our data gets better, then I think we're in a position where we can look at altering the ingredients in the formula. Categorical funding is one of the primary issues at heart, and that gets into looking at categorical generation of revenue as opposed to categorical expenditure. The funding formula group is looking at categorical generation of revenue in several areas, as we'll outline, but not categorical expenditure. I believe that's proper, in that until you have a highly tuned system that says revenue generation is closely associated with expenditure, we should be looking at gathering good data in order to support the expenditure side. So when we get to our special program areas, special education, bilingual, we are looking at categorical generation of revenue with the requirement that if a student receives funding or is counted for funding, the student must receive a service. The service must meet a specified standard. And then we need to cost out those programs over a period of time and then determine if the revenue generation is really proper. There are a lot of different ways of offering programs, and And the idea of trying to tie down every dollar to a program is really not cost effective, nor is it in the best interest of education as I would see it at this time. So we are looking at categorical generation of revenue, non-categorical expenditure, with the primary need to gather good cost data over a period of several years in our personnel areas and in our non-personnel cost areas in order to determine the actual cost of offering programs. With that, I would like to turn to the functional outline. We'll really be going through this in conjunction with the paragraphs that are titled on the first few pages of the description. And then we'll take, or I'll pause for questions as we go, or please feel free to stop me. The programs then that are being considered, or the ingredients of the formula, are listed under the programs and then the adjustment factors. So just looking at the functional outline page, by program we're looking at the major components where students would be grouped for funding purposes. In the K-12 area, the program areas for funding would be, as outlined, kindergarten, and then grouped grades 1 and 2, 3 through 6, 7 through 12. Then in special education, we have four programs that are listed. Then bilingual and vocational, which is included for funding as a part of grade 7-12. The other major components of the formula are the small schools, which are referenced under the first start item under total ADM, and the adjustment factors, one personnel, one non-personnel. The ones included in this first run of data are training and experience, shortened on the form to T&E, and in the non-personnel area. There's also another personnel index which has been generated. It's called a salary schedule index, which is not included in this first draft for running data. May very well be one of the adjustments that will be run as we look at how to fine-tune over the next 2 or 3 months the formula before it comes to you. The funding base in the second column is essentially students. ADM, average daily membership, is just looking at the numbers of kids. In kindergarten, we call it ADM FTE, meaning simply that on a full-time equivalent base, or FTE, kids count either half or full, depending upon whether they attend school, their program being half or full. Special education, you see that the funding base is listed as programs, but on the separate sheet that you see entitled Special Education, dated October 3rd, or today's date, you see that in order to generate programs, students are again the input base. And just momentarily looking at the special...
You just lost this person.
Okay.
Okay. I went forward to 10-3. Now, would you mind going over that again? We've gone from your functional outline.
Right.
What did you just say?
Okay. We just, under the functional outline, it lists programs under the base column. The second sheet, dated October 3rd, is how programs are determined, how many programs. And so on that, students are also the input base. Programs are generated from this set of categories, and then from the financial side, it would be programs which count. Kids are still the input base, but programs are the outcome of the October 3rd sheet.
May I interrupt you there?
Certainly.
Another question. Mm-hmm. That's the small school weighted students. How did you generate these numbers? I noticed that I'm mentally graphing them
right
up and down,
okay.
And I would have assumed it's sort of two lines approaching.
Which is correct. If it's all right to hold the question until I get to small schools, then I will handle. If I don't, please bring me back now. Just on the special education sheet then, just a few comments on that, some of the bases for the information. You see the four programs areas listed. Basically, there's a target number for each of those areas, such as in resource services, you see that the target is 18, so that you have one per 18 students in resource services. Now, the two default levels right below that, and all of the default levels that you would see, and basically, I mean, if you're under the target, you still generate some level of program support. And this was designed in part of our small school concern and problem. And here, looking at our small schools in serving very small numbers of special education students. We can have one or two students, there still must be a service. And so the default levels were determined through working with the Special Education Program Standards Committee, where we met for several days. The committee has met 5 days now. And this is the latest that's come from there, and looking at support for small school special ed programs. So that from 1 to 8 students in the resource service area, you still generate half a program. Now, half a program is only a funding concept. All it does is generate dollars. And basically what we find is that we probably have a part-time teacher serving these students in our very small schools. And so this is a funding basis only. Now, when we get up to 18 or more, you simply take the number of kids and divide by 18. There are no huge jumps. If you divide 20 by 18, you get 1 1/9, and that becomes the funding base. It's not that you jump another whole program. And the same is true in each of the other areas. There are default levels built in so that one student who demands service in special ed still has a funding base. And so throughout, we have looked at support for small schools, building a floor into our small schools, and then trying to build a realistic caseload level for the larger schools. That's the function of these four tables in special education. In the bilingual area, and I'm shifting back to the functional outline page, ADM again becomes the funding base. And in vocational, as I indicated earlier, vocational is a function of the 7 through 12 average daily membership. It's built in as a component and is not recognized for independent funding. Part of the rationale for that, which has come through the funding formula group, is that vocational education is different from special education and bilingual education fundamentally in student differences. There are federal and state laws that state that children with identified needs, and we're looking at kid differences now, children in bilingual, of course, who have a language other than English as a primary language, or special education needs, there are student differences that must be met through educational programming. That is different from vocational education, where we're looking at essentially student choice for curricular alternatives. The philosophy that's come through the FFAC has been that vocational is different, should be treated differently, as part of the 7-12 program, as a curricular alternative, such as social sciences, mathematics, pure science, and other alternatives that are offered in our regular program. Now, that's the rationale primarily that speaks to why vocational is not separately identified at this point.
On that subject, I apologize, I'm late on the court, but I have to go back there, so I want to get the question asked.
Sure.
Wow, I'm curious. Is that, first of all, let me ask you, is that a universally accepted notion of vocational education? It seems to me in some countries and cultures, there are tracking methods where it's not a question of choice in the same way that you choose French or Spanish. It's a question of suiting a youngster's aptitude for a program that will allow for gainful employment. That's my first proposition or question to you.
Well, I would hesitate to say there's any universal definition, because really we have a major problem in the state now of defining what vocational education is. And some of our major topics within the formula funding group has been, well, if we're, superintendent might say, well, if we're looking at my definition of vocational education, then such and such is true, but if we're looking at yours being the state, that may not be true. And so it's difficult in the finite sense to say vocational education is, and therefore it includes this and excludes that. Typically what happens is that vocational education is whatever is approved by the state, and it isn't whatever isn't approved by the state. And that's created some rather huge problems, and within the state of that definitional problem, the superintendents, I shouldn't say superintendents, but superintendents, business people, or the primary group on the funding formula group, the philosophy that's come out of that is that it isn't defined enough separately that it should be excluded. It is part of the whole, and that we have as many cost differences in vocational programs within the so-called range of vocational as we do without. And so that therefore it should not be excluded. We get into things like, well, is industrial arts vocational? Is beginning woods? If I offered in the eighth grade, it isn't, but if it's in the ninth grade, it is. Those kinds of things, where different schools will offer different programs at different levels. And so from the school standpoint, the emphasis coming through is leave it broad, let local school districts define it, and let the funding be broad.
But what would be the practical, what would be the likely practical effect for our constituents? Would we find vocational education in a new kind of competition for money, and therefore maybe we're getting less and less support for local level?
Well, there are arguments on both sides, and certainly during the last 3 years, without identified funding for vocational education, it's been left up to local boards as to which programs they would or should offer. On one side, we know that some of the data says there are less students in vocational education. Then you get both sides of the argument saying, well, now we don't push kids, quote unquote, into vocational ed because no funding is tied to it. And then on the other side of that, we would say there are approximately 90% of the same programs being offered without any funding push, so therefore those programs must be needed programs in the eyes of local boards, and therefore by far and away the programs have existed. And so therefore funding must not be the primary push. Basically it comes down to my feeling is that superintendents, local boards, local communities will still demand those programs which meet the needs of their kids, whether or not they are defined as purely vocational or not, and therefore the primary need is to ensure adequate funding, regardless of whether it's generated on 7, 12, or identified independent funding.
Larry, in that line, and as we go through with trying to defend what is this thing called vocab in order to be able to fill it, figure in this component, or that will that be the door open for us developing further inequalities in funding or economic problems? If I remember correctly, for the opening, that was one of the things that started creating a problem within the foundation fund that we had. Am I on the wrong track?
No, I believe all the issues are quite proper. The way that it's outlined now, it would be immaterial from a funding sense how vocational ed is defined. It would leave it strictly up to local boards of education to install those programs within the total generated revenue that they felt were proper. Whether they were vocational in the district's eyes or the state's eyes would be immaterial. Now, another consideration that's being discussed is not part of the formula per se, but may very well become a proposal within the total context of proposed funding, is what's been termed a high-cost vocational equipment fund. It was talked about 1 year ago. The Funding Formula Committee has agreed to consider the concept, although no definitive proposal has been put forth. But this would, if that would come to be, would create another conceptual area in that would have to be tied down in some manner or means to define programs, where the formula now as presented here is general and would not require defined programs. If we actually tie some funding to, quote, vocational programs, unquote, they would have to be defined so we know which programs are in and which aren't. Raises a lot of other
reasons that it's left within the context of
general funding.
General education. That makes sense.
Correct.
To me.
Right.
You have in the specialized category, special appropriation for offer services for low income.
And I think that's one of the concepts that has been discussed, is trying to perhaps limit to those either advanced classes, extremely high cost, so that high cost really is high cost, and try to maybe define it as junior, senior level, advanced level, or certain defined programs where you're looking at, as you would say, a lower incidence, highly defined, high cost program. And that could work.
It looks, Larry, as though you've handled one of the major problems in the current formula, the 7 to 12, so there's no differentiation as to how they organize, say, junior high, senior high.
Yes, ma'am.
But I'm wondering about the how is correspondence being handled, and also maintenance. Does that come, is there a maintenance figure that comes into the basic cost of the weight
effect? Yes, ma'am. Yes. Maintenance. In fact, just looking at the weights would be the next major area we'd look at. The weights, and I'm looking just at K-12 weights now, where all children are counted in the K-12 area first. So we're trying to first get a complete student count within K-12, where the weights, the 1.3, the 1.15, et cetera, carry the weight not only of the personnel, but of the non-personnel, administrative overhead, operations, and maintenance costs. Those weights carry that full load. Our other weights in special ed and bilingual, we are looking there at strictly personnel costs, direct instruction and related services costs in special ed, and not trying to further carry all of our overhead costs. So with all children being counted in the K-12, we're trying to handle all of those costs there. And then our other areas are looking at direct instructional services, which are above and beyond the so-called basic program, the basic K-12. Now, just going on then with weights, if there are no questions at this point, the weights are derived from the resource cost model program committees. This is the one area that we did utilize some of the work of those program committees. We're not looking at cost data from the RCM. In fact, we utilize essentially no cost data from the resource cost model approach. That's one of the basic differences. Significantly different in that respect, in that dollars become assigned by the state legislature and are not determined by the formula itself. And that's a key difference. Virtually all of our funding is unit generated, not dollar generated. Dollars become applied at the end. So the formula is a distribution formula of whatever dollars the legislature appropriates in one of two means, either on a strict dollar per unit or on an appropriation which would convert to a dollar per unit. And so as we work through, we are looking at a formula that is different from the RCM, but we did utilize some non-dollar cost data from the RCM, and those were essentially pupil-teacher ratio and caseload numbers that came out of the program committees. This is the area where we're looking at the so-called what ought to be as opposed to what is, and we're looking at so-called best practice, what the people in the field in Alaska looked at as target loads, pupil-teacher ratios for these various program areas. Now, as we talked earlier, we simplified greatly. And so when we look at a 7-12 program as an example, we are encompassing many, many programs that were outlined separately in the resource cost model. In the 7-12 program includes vocational education. It includes 7th and 8th grade programs in all of the various component areas. It includes the high school programs, mathematics, science, English, art, music, PE. All of those are encompassed in our 7-12. Now, we utilize that data on the targets, numbers, or pupil-teacher ratio to develop our weight. The 1.25 simply meaning that when we look at the pupil-teacher ratios associated with our 7-12 program, we have smaller pupil-teacher ratios than we do in the grade 3 through 6, which is our base program, typically the lowest cost because it has a higher pupil-teacher ratio. Basically, all the weights are saying at this point is that where you have a low pupil-teacher ratio, you have higher costs. And typically, we know that's true. We know also that virtually 80%, plus or minus, of our costs are tied up in personnel costs. We know, all my past work dictates, that when you have looked at your pupil-teacher ratios, you know your weighting factors, because that's your personnel costs. And your personnel costs are 80%, the plus or minus. So I feel very strongly that we have solid weights, given the pupil-teacher ratio data, which is good data, that's laid before us. Why a 1.3 in kindergarten? Low pupil-teacher ratio. Doesn't mean that everyone has it. It means that the funding would support it. 1.15 in grades 1 and 2 doesn't mean that every grade 1 and 2 has a lower pupil-teacher ratio than kindergarten, but the funding would support it. And therefore, the weighting's higher, generates more dollars for the numbers of kids in that area. Typically, we know that that is what happens, and that we try to have lower pupil-teacher ratios in our primary grades. We also know that in our grades 7 through 12, we do run many programs with low pupil-teacher ratios. We also run programs that have high pupil-teacher ratios. Some programs, such like band or PE, will have a higher pupil-teacher ratio. Those are factored in. We also know that vocational education typically has lower pupil-teacher ratios. Those are factored in. And so the basis for the weights are the caseload pupil-teacher ratios. In special education, the weight of 20, as I have indicated, at this point is still approximated. I feel it's really close. It's approximated primarily at this point because, as I've indicated earlier, the kids are already counted in K-12. And so we are not going to support all of the same services again that we have supported in K-12. And so typically you have somewhere around a 25% support level, 20-25. And so we know that this figure should be approximately that percentage lower than the typical weighted classroom. And by that I would mean, if you take our 3-6 program area with a base of 1, and if there are 23 kids in that classroom, which was the target, you'd have a program weight of 23. Well, in a special ed classroom, still supporting a teacher, perhaps an aid-related service, we're going to have a lesser weight than that because these kids have been counted before. So really what we're doing now, we are generating special ed program data. I still have approximately 1/3 the school districts who have not submitted that data. And so I'm running on approximated numbers in parts of that area. The 20 will be close, maybe slightly high, could be adjusted. The 0.7 bilingual number, again, all of these kids have been counted before. So we're only looking at additional costs of bilingual. And again, we're looking at target data, which would say that we have a caseload out of the RCM of approximately 15-1. That yields a higher weight than the typical program in K-6 or K-12. And as we ran that data, we made two assumptions. The first was that generally the children are pulled from K-6, so therefore we ran a weighted loading over K-6, compared it to a bilingual weighting. And the numbers were approximately 1.8 for bilingual and 1.1 on a general average over K-6, realizing that grades 3, 4, 5, and 6 are weighted at 1, and the difference is an add-on 0.7. We don't know about the $3,500.
I know. I'm
okay.
Say whatever. That
sounds good to me, but I don't know.
And that's what that kid gets. Now you get another kid who needs special education. He'll get in the school district will get $70,000.
No. The student on their grade 4, the student would be weighted at 1, as you said.
Right.
Now in special education, the kid would be counted. And I'm switching sheets now to the program categories. In one of these four areas, just as one kid.
Right.
So the kid would make up somewhere a program, but he would be 1/18 of a program or maybe 1/10, depending upon this child's special education needs, and, or 1/40th, or perhaps 1/3 in the intensive.
I see. So the 20 is for the program. Not
20
the
is the program, and not the kid.
I'm okay. I'm not.
Good point. Good point, and that's why we want to review it.
And let me ask one more, Madam Chairman, because I have to report to you.
What do you do?
I'm not real familiar with all this stuff. What does self-contained services mean? What do you mean when you say self-contained?
Okay, basically what that means, and the special ed committee just spent 2 days trying to get the language, so... basically, that means a student who is served in a classroom essentially over half the time, that this child's needs, his special education service says that he is mainstreamed or in regular classrooms less than half of the day. So that most of the child's program is in a special ed classroom where the special ed teacher has the primary responsibility for this child's program. Now that's in contrast to a resource service where the student is in the regular program over half the time, whose program is the responsibility of the regular classroom teacher and who goes to special education services a minority of the time. So it becomes a level of need of the student.
Well, they get the same amount of units, 20 each.
Yeah,
so
see,
why make a distinction between?
Well, it's because of the number of students that go into the program. And this, so it takes much fewer students, and that's why it is, right.
All right. Thank you, Madam Chairman.
Two questions. The first one, I guess, is a general one. I don't know if it's commissioner or not, but in relation to the bilingual program, the Secretary of Education recently came out and stated that the bilingual program in the United States were not meeting the goals or the needs that were not successful, and therefore there's a movement to kind of back away or do away with them. I wonder if we've had any evaluation on our bilingual programs in Alaska, whether we get the money's worth or whether they're needed or not.
Well, you know, I don't know how much evaluation has been done. I know the issue is extremely complex and highly controversial, and I know that Secretary Bennett's remarks have been taken just that way, highly controversial, in that some people, and we've all been through it, you as well as I, I'm sure, where some people will swear by the immersion method, where you just immerse the child in English and ignore the child's home language, and you can get just as many people saying that's wrong. It's best to teach the child in his home language, even to the point of being fluent in the home language. And I don't want to, I can't argue the issue.
Or whether we will have an evaluation.
We have an ongoing evaluation.
And I guess my other question is more concerned about is, how are you going to treat within the, say, 7 through 12, the extracurricular program, which really is funding student activities outside of their district, such as athletics or student leadership programs like teaching farmers,
okay, basically the data that we have used would essentially be utilizing existing practice. And so that... Well, they could or could not be. You could do it one of two ways. We could either take the monies that are appropriated independently, run those through the formula where they are distributed on a per unit basis and everybody gets a piece, and then you say that everyone has got it and you fund it within the total, or we turn right around and say, no, unless you give it to me independently and I can see it right here, I won't do it. And that gets
that's
more a philosophical question.
I remember several years ago, within the formula funding program, justification was argued to fund extracurricular activities, and that was based into the program. But at the same time then, the school district justified a higher foundation program funding because of extracurricular activities. Yet they still continued to make separate requests to carry on the same program, and the money was never used for extracurricular activities.
Now, the only thing I can answer is that most of our extracurricular costs are within this total because the cost of those programs are within the operational budgets now, and those are the figures that we're using. So generally, our costs for athletics or extracurricular travel and coaching and sponsors and that are included. Now, there may be some particulars, you know, that would not be, that become very small pieces of the total. But generally speaking, this would include the major of travel and athletic travel and student travel, and those things are in there because they're in the total cost.
Let me pursue that a little further. If then the superintendent of schools, say in district PQR, decided that was outside of the scope of their priorities, their funding would be there to fund that, but they used it for other things. Then it would be left to the local people to cut his head off instead of him coming to us and saying, we want some more money because we need for travel. Is that correct?
Yes, ma'am. Say
no. Madam Chair, what happened before, though, was it was put into the foundation program to help fund extracurricular activities, but it was used for something else. And then they still came back from the local district or to the state to fund those programs separately. And I want to make sure either one way or the other, that they don't have it both ways again.
Well, the general philosophy of the entire formula is basically the formula is a revenue-generating instrument. And it would do a lot of different things as we're reviewing in order to calculate this revenue. But when you get down to item F on my functional outline page, there would be one pot of dollars. And those dollars would become that pot, and we're looking at state dollars, raised a lot of other issues on the local support issue that we haven't talked about, but those dollars become general in nature. And although dollars are generated for a lot of different areas, there's no requirement that we really have a pupil-teacher ratio of such and such. The local board really has virtual total discretion within the laws of the state for offering the program within the resources available.
I'm really trying to sort through as to what the impact does. I mean, the formula is one thing, because it's revenue generating and it's unit based. It seems like the effect ought to be to force management out there in terms of negotiating contracts and costs. Is that correct? Because cost doesn't come into setting the amount that you're going to have, but it seems like that if you don't get any kind of benefit if you have higher costs, the way we have it now, if we just pass on and give an area differential, say, what we're doing is really putting a stamp on that cost or some benefit for it. Am I missing something?
Well, there's really two areas. We haven't gotten into the training and experience and non-personnel areas that we really are looking at adjusting our units for existing costs. One, in personnel, where a district has high training and experience, there would be an adjustment to add units, which adds revenue, to adjust for the higher costs of training and experience. And training and experience simply means on our teacher salary schedules that are based upon either degrees or hours beyond a degree or number of years. If I stay in a district a good many years, or if I go to school and get more degrees and hours, I cost more. And we have a number of our districts that show very high training and experience, very high cost. That factor would adjust for some of those costs. The non-personnel index, at this point, we're still trying to develop the final index. I think we have the concept in hold now, but basically it's looking at non-personnel costs, which largely we're looking at a 10-to-1 ratio right now, where we do have highly dispersed districts, numbers of sites, small numbers of kids, high utility costs. So we are offsetting in that area for some of those high costs, just trying to look at what are the funding needs out there that a state formula can look at. We cannot reimburse every program that's out there, nor should we try, but we need to look at least at broad, general, major, significant costs of a school district. And basically, we're looking at small schools as very high cost, training and experience, and non-personnel. Now, there may be some others come into play before we're said and done, but those are the major ones.
Follow up on that, then. If within the school board negotiations with teachers or personnel, not just teachers, but if in those personnel negotiations, the school board would say tend to be very lenient and give a higher priority to have money for teachers, then the program areas could, of their own choice, suffer.
That's correct.
Is that correct?
That's correct.
So within the capabilities, within the formula, the capability is built in there for the local then some area will suffer and they'll come yelling to us. Is that
or just the opposite? In other words, you're providing kind of an optimum situation that salary should be this amount, that there's normally this many degree teachers or this many with advanced degrees.
No, we're not doing that.
And if you hire people without degrees, you're going to have more money to spend somewhere else.
No.
People with high degrees.
In that area, if you have lesser training and experience, your revenue is adjusted lesser. So if you have higher training and experience, then the offset's greater. So we're not doing an average there.
Well, the
whole philosophy is, from my view, hire the best person. Now, if the best person happens to be one with two MAs in 15 years that cost me $60,000, and that's the person that's the best one, there should not be an incentive to hire a brand new teacher for $25,000 because they cost less. You should go after the best person. And so there's an offset here that says, if you hire that person, we know they cost you more, there's a revenue offset to offset your expenditure. And to try to get us out of the incentive-disincentive game about let's retire our old-timers and hire new. Now, if that's the right thing to do for educational reasons, fine, then we ought to do it. And then if you hire low, it costs you less, you should receive less. But the philosophy of the formula is to adjust revenue to general expense, not to reimburse expenditure, but to offset and try to recognize in a formula general areas of revenue generation to look at major cost areas. No. Either way you go, your index goes up or down.
Okay, the philosophy is there, whatever exists in your district is what you'll be paid for.
Whatever, and yes, you're being paid on a what is. It has nothing to do with how much you pay them, it's just where they are on your schedule. Now, how much you pay them gets in a negotiations game, which the state formula should not be dictating. All we're looking at is an offset. How much you pay your people is your business. But the offset gets into where the people are on your schedule, not how much you pay them.
I mean, I'm puzzled a little bit. I guess you might say how much you pay your people is your business. If you make it your business to pay them a very, very high salary, you're saying then the state is going to pay them whatever they determine.
No. The state's response is only to where you are on the schedule on an index basis. We could, and that's another piece of our paper here called the State Training and Experience Ratio Schedule. And on that, you'll see the ratios. This is not designed to duplicate any district schedule. In fact, it does not do that. What we did was examine all 53 schedules on a lot more points than you see on this table. Then we condensed it to these points that you see here, smoothed it up to, essentially, they're all multiples of 500s. It's pretty good in that it looks at our state pretty well in looking at our 53 schedules. But as you would see from this, and the technique or procedural means of using this is that in every district, you take how many people you have on your own schedule, and then we would count those people to fit these blocks. Now, what we call mid-BA is probably more appropriately termed mid-BA slash MA. It's the people who are paid on some step above a BA step, but below an MA step, and we just count the people. And then you count the people who are at MA, and then you count the people who are above an MA step up to MA 18, and these are semester hour steps. But procedurally, you count people at each one of these steps, times the index, sum the products, divide by people. The results of that are on the reverse side. So we know from this, once we've done that, is that every district is going to have some average of their people between 1 and 2. Base is 1, max is 2. And you can see what that does. It says if I'm at the high end, I have more people in higher years and higher degrees and hours. Therefore, I have higher costs. But it doesn't look at what the costs are. It's a revenue-generating mechanism to offset an expenditure. So it keeps us out of what you're really paying your teachers, because we're looking at an index based upon all 53 schedules in order to get the indices, but stay out of the dollars.
Yes.
Did you get all 53 schedules?
Yes, sir, I did.
Getting information back from 53 districts.
Might be. I don't have all 53 fiscal reports, however.
And my question is, what is the student-teacher ratio?
The target was 18.
18. And I believe I heard you say that you think the funding would support that.
Well, the weight, the 1.3, is designed to support that. That's correct. That's how the 1.3 is derived.
What? Discussions on the committee, given the fact that kindergarten is not a required program, what was your thinking in including it as you have as addressed?
It is included for those districts that, who do offer it. I mean, it is an existing program within the K-12 spectrum of education, and it's based upon half the whole thing.
Get some information, if I might, as to what. Of the districts that offer kindergarten at present, how many, in fact, have a student-teacher ratio of 18? Because I think that is very low. That would be wrong, but I would be very surprised if the majority of districts, in fact, have a student-teacher ratio of 18.
Yeah, I'm saying that was never our concern about what they are doing. It was our concern about what they would be able to do. That's
if you
correct.
Had a higher number in there, you would be getting a little bit of an over appropriation for kindergarten, which you could use then wherever you choose to use it. But it might provide some incentive for reducing that number if 18 is the optimum, you know, considered kind of an optimum number.
That's correct. Now, that's really true in virtually every area that we're looking at the general means of generating revenue. And it applies the ability to do some things that we would say are desirable. Basically, we're saying it's desirable to have smaller pupil-teacher ratios in kindergarten grades 1 and 2. And that's the philosophy that's built into this. Now, whether or not the local board really does it is another question. Now, it would kind of throw some heat, if you will, or at least pressure to say to a local community, you are receiving funds that would enable you to do this. Now, I realize that if we're at 25, we may not get to 18 in 1 year, but there may be some pressures to say, we want to reduce our pupil-teacher ratios in grades 1 and 2. But that becomes local prerogative, not mandate, although the funding formula would recognize the ability financially to do these kinds of things. That's correct. And you get into capital kinds of concerns that we'd really love to have 3 more classrooms. We just don't happen to have them. Right.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
The concern that I have when I've seen the salary schedule is the same concern I have when I've seen the Madison Borough or other salary schedules over the years. And that is that the highest cost of education is salary. One of the things that determines the cost of education then is the step increases that you have along the line. Now, I think what you have here is good, but I think it has to have a certain caveat here. That is, if you're going to pay someone at a master's degree level or more, they should be working in that profession or within that field. In other words, they have a master's in mathematics, they should be teaching math. But yet I see so many times we're paying for master's degrees or for advanced credit for someone teaching junior high English, and they take golf for the summer and get a higher pay for that. I think it's time we start addressing that, and this might be some way for the state to address that on a local level, saying we're going to pay for a master's degree provided the individual is teaching within that field. And we're going to pay for additional credit provided the teacher is trying to improve himself within their field of work.
I wouldn't disagree, but this may be an incentive, but this won't answer that problem.
I'd like to say here that we're going to run into, no matter what kind of formula we use in education, the capability and local control. If we start taking over control of education, we've really got the problem with any form of control.
Dollars are controlled. And,
not necessarily. Well, I was trying to say. Two questions. One, programs get out of date sometimes very rapidly, and then politically it's difficult to change them. What is there in this program that will become out of date? Is it going to be, let's assume by some magic the numbers are right and we get the program in and accept it. What happens in 2 years or 3 years? What kind of maintenance does it need to keep it good and current and relevant, if you will?
Well, my personal view is that it's an ongoing process. Now, we are, in all honesty, just in the beginning stages of getting what I would term good and consistent fiscal and personnel data from the field. We are just beginning that effort, and I think we have made some inroads on it. I think it will need to be improved. I think we have a lot of work to do in getting consistency in accounting and reporting of data. I think we need to keep up with that, and I think it's an ongoing task, and that the types of data that I think we should need and begin to collect are in two areas: personnel, in numbers of personnel and in personnel costs, and in the, what I'll term the non-personnel costs, which basically is everything except the salaries and the benefit data. We need the personnel data and student data in order to look at our pupil-teacher ratios to begin to answer some of the questions that we brought up here, that if indeed we are funding in a given way that supports pupil-teacher ratios over there, are we moving in that direction? Where are we, you know? We may very well be, and I would not dispute at all that our pupil-teacher ratios are probably higher. But are we moving in a direction that says we're putting money out there? Are we moving in smaller pupil-teacher ratios for kindergarten or whatever else? Begin to look at our personnel and cost data to justify the program and student weights. That should be done, I would think, every 3 to 5 years. In fact, it's one of the things the funding formula group has looked at, about at what points should we be looking at recommendations for modification. Basically, we're looking at 3 to 5. Special education and bilingual and vocational data, I think we should be collecting program data. Is our 20 or 18 or whatever we end up with, is that generating the revenue that's associated with the expense of the program? Well, we need to look at how programs are staffed. What kind of costs do we have? What kind of related services costs? I mean, we're looking at collecting data, which I think needs to look at the ingredients in the formula.
One final question. To go on to the end of the thing, where you deduct city and borough and that's
another major issue.
Before, because I just wonder, let's say I'm from a community that puts very high value on education and raising teacher scores, and we want to do extra things. Are we going to just get penalized no matter what we put in? We just lose that amount of money from the state? Is that the way it's designed, or is there another?
We get into, and this, you know, we probably ought to take other questions, maybe, because this will become a major area of concern in the equity issue.
Okay. I just have one question, maybe on special ed, and I've been trying to think of where we might be looking at abuses or loopholes.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm kind of wondering if you've got a lot of that data collected now, so that you know probably what kind of programs are in existence now, so that if suddenly we have a proliferation of either intensive services or self-contained. I mean, looking at this little chart here, if I had 12 students that might require resource services over here and I get one program equivalent for them, maybe I could put them over here and say they need self-contained services. Now, those 12, I could put 6 in one room and 6 in another room, and I could get 2 programs.
We've
heard some of these horror stories where maybe some kids are kind of put into special ed situations because the funding is greater, and it seems like since the funding seems to be so much greater in special ed, that sometimes it's worth the district's while to claim some of those services, and maybe that's where some of them. I know it can't be prevented, but I guess I'm wondering if there might be some way of monitoring that with some existing statistics. So if there's a great proliferation of one of these very intensive programs, maybe there'd be an ability to look at it so we could tell
This is precisely the problem in any special interest area, and certainly special education is the largest of those. Now, that was the primary goal of the last 2 days of that standards meeting, was to write definitions of these areas which would, to the largest degree possible, prevent just what you said, to provide clear guidance as to which types of needs, and this again gets into individual education plans, the IEPs, as to the child's needs and the service to meet those needs, and to define the areas. Now, these are existing areas right now, and these are not new to the field. The idea is to tighten up the definitions from the state level. These become state level program standards, regulatory, or at least standard definitions. And then in the monitoring process, which goes on with the state and the school districts, that the district has to support within existing definitions and the needs of the child, as determined through the IEP, where these kids are counted. So our concern, like yours, is to prevent manipulation for fiscal purposes. We must meet the needs of the kid by providing a service, required, but the proper service, a defined service. And so I agree with the concern, and we're trying to do everything possible that what you say will be minimized.
Yes.
Thank you, Chairman. I just wanted to follow up on the data. I know that's been a problem for the department for years, and I'm not being the least bit facetious when I suggest it might be the first time in the state that I've got to be in this and send you the right data. I would like to see the department follow the additional regulations so that we could have sure the collection of data from all now 55 districts, because you can't make decisions like this in the absence of that data. And whatever it takes, and I say this now to my colleagues, that means we have to force districts to come through with data before they get their money, so be it. But we can't make decisions based on a half collection of data from 55 school districts. So that's one thing. And the second that is an auxiliary problem is the question of audits. Part of this is surpluses, and in reading this and how you're approaching this, that's going to be something that will be discussed long and hard, too. But I think you need consistent audits. I'd like to see the department promulgate some regulations that ensure we get consistent audits. You have audits that come in and they're done, again, to manipulate, I can't feel that it's done any other way, to manipulate the numbers. Audits, you talk about creative accounting, my God, some of the ways you get audits from school districts around the state astonish me. Some people apparently never heard or generally accepted accounting principles. But I would like to, and I quote, I'm addressing myself to the state school board members there as much as I'm anybody. But those are two things that I think, if we're going to make changes as significant as this, we've got to take care of the whole ball of wax. We must take care of regulations to ensure timely and accurate collection of data and decent audits from all 55 school districts.
President Thomas, that's come up, as you know, many times in the financial considerations, and every time you try to work on a foundation formula, and then you find very little disagreement within the legislature anywhere about the accounting principles. It maybe has something that the school board did. We should address that tomorrow, which would give them many times they fear to tread in areas where they don't really have complete control.
Well, yeah, for example, because I did a lot of work on that when I chaired Budget and Audit about audits, the management letters, the fact they were never reviewed. We do not, you know, they're submitted, the audits are, but there's not any mandatory legislation that says that the department does anything with that. There has been a lot of work by the School Board Association in attempting to get some demonstration programs to get the accounting terms the same. And whether that needs statutes or a regulation, I don't know how much it's, you know, somebody might want to look at it to see what does happen to those audits when the information comes in and if there's any attempt to move towards standardization.
Well, and while we're at it, we might as well look at ourselves. We are supposed to be the school board of the REAA. When did we met with the school board? I mean, we're telling the department what to do, but we better clean up our own house before we
call me. Yeah.
I better clean up my own house before we go. Yeah. I think that's what budget audit
is. Harry, you brought up pupil-teacher ratio. I guess the question would be a general one. First of all, in coming up with a formula here, or within your work, have you determined any optimum or a few
Okay, to probably go from the last to first, the pupil-teacher ratio is classroom teacher with the number of students. Now, the data that's being used was that derived from the program cost committees, and I guess the best way I could describe that would be, I assume that through those committees they were looking at what they felt was optimum, that what ought to be, that if we were looking at staffing the ideal school, this is what we would do. Now, that's the data that we use. Now, I was not party to all of those committee meetings. Well, it's different throughout. I don't have all of them here. I know we started with a target of 23 in 3 through 6. I remember kindergarten was 18. But see, then we began to, we combined a lot of programs, like in, 162 programs down to these few. So we end up with, like, in the typical classroom, there might be 23. But then we factor in music, which might be 150 kids per teacher. So we factor in that over the course of a week. Then we factor in PE, which might be 150 or somewhere like 450.
How do you factor in the support staff?
Okay, and those were spread over the top. The support staff was spread over the top equally. Like a piece of the superintendent's time is given to kindergarten, just like the senior. And so we factored those over the top of all.
Some districts pay school board members,
some don't.
Pardon me? Some districts pay school board members.
Well, we just factor the cost over. Now, if the cost included that, they're factored over it. If they don't, I mean, there are different things. But we factor those costs over the top. Those that are not directly assignable to a grade level were factored over the top. So that's how we accounted for the overhead.
And just to follow up on that, though, I think maybe one part of Ron's question I didn't hear an answer to. If you factored those over the top, then you had to assume that there was, if there was a superintendent, then there was so many assistant superintendents or this director of secondary education or something. I mean, and I think that's the thing that Ron was asking, and I'd like to know that also. You had to. If you factored them in there, then you have some bases, and I'd like to know what that is.
Well, the bases for factoring in the overhead is that, from a technical standpoint, it doesn't change the weighting at all as long as you factor it over the tops of all of them. And whether you add a little bit to each one or a lot to each one.
If you add five positions and factor it in all the way, or if you had seven positions, I guess that's what I want to know. If there were five positions that were...
We would be factoring in the overhead costs, not necessarily positions here.
Okay,
some people...
How did you arrive at the overhead cost?
We're using existing costs.
And how did you take all the districts that you have and average it out by the districts?
Well, we know that in fiscal 85, there are like $490 million that were expended. Overall.
How do you take that down to the superintendent and the assistant superintendent and the secretary and the...
There's that overhead cost could include any and does include all of those. And those are laid over the top evenly. It doesn't change the weight. All we're saying is that the weighting carries that entire cost. We didn't get down into trying to see whether you should have one assistant superintendent or two or a half-time principal or that. Well beyond what we could do at this point in this study. Now, what we did do on the early part, where it gets a part of what you're looking at, is to say within the resource cost model study, again, if you're looking at typically in a given size district, you have a superintendent, maybe an assistant superintendent, principals, and all that, we took those for different class sizes of schools and laid those over the top, looked at the various classes of schools. The technical part of it is that no matter which way you go, it doesn't change the weight. Because no matter which one you are laying over the top, it still doesn't change.